Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Acacia Jarvis from Dallas, Texas, and you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but three to ride. 16 coaches. I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around the bend, and I ain't seen the sun.
Great balls of fire.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Let me read you a short biography of Sam Phillips. It's actually the book cover for the new long biography of Sam Phillips. This is what you see on the front cover of the book. Sam Phillips, the man who invented rock and roll. How one man discovered Howlin' Wolf, Ike Turner, Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, and Elvis Presley. Wait, I'm not done. And how his tiny label, Sun Records of Memphis, revolutionized the world. Then it says, Peter Guralnick, author of Last Train to Memphis and Careless Love. Phew, and they still managed to fit a picture of Sam Phillips and Elvis Presley on this packed front cover. Peter Guralnick, what follows is 700 pages on the life and work of Sam Phillips. First of all, welcome to Soundcheck.
Well, thanks. It's great to be here.
And obviously, there is a lot to say about this guy. Even on the front cover of the book. We live in the age of the superstar producer, you know, where DJ slash producers have become the biggest moneymakers in the music world. And here is a guy who, in a sense, was the first kind of producer in that vein, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, but in a very different vein, in a sense. The term producer didn't exist, and he would disown the term producer, because what he was interested in doing was not putting his imprint on the record that he was making. He was interested in bringing out a talent, a passion, an ability to describe and present him or herself that they might not know they had themselves. So every record represents an idiosyncratic direction dictated entirely by the fundamental genius of the artist.
So there are two stories here. One, obviously, is the story of Sam Phillips, but the other is your story of kind of chasing after this guy and finally getting him. I mean, he was your great white whale, it seems.
Well, every story I've ever done has been my great white whale, but it took 10 years before I could get an interview with him. When I finally met Sam in 1979, he considered it the first interview that he had ever done outside of the Memphis newspapers and the trades like Billboard and Cashbox. He did not believe in doing interviews at all. He believed that that represented looking back, and throughout his life until his death at the age of 70, he was committed to looking forward.
Well, he was. I mean, this is one of the immediately striking things about this guy. He doesn't just have good ears. He's in the middle of America, in the middle of the 20th century, and he has very kind of modern progressive ideas about some pretty important things. Mental illness, for one thing. You know, the idea that it's just an illness like anything else, and something that he struggled with. And of course, race relations. The idea that, you know, there was something elemental and fundamentally American in the black music community that the rest of America wasn't hearing.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was living in a world, in a music world, that was as segregated as the rest of the country. And music was divided sharply into two categories. I mean, you had hillbilly music, you had what was called race music, which then became R&B. His belief from the time he was a child, long before he ever opened up the studio in 1950, his belief that it was music that could knock down the walls of segregation. And when he started putting out records, Sam was talking, even then in 1951, about how the idea that this was not music that was going to be confined to one category. This was music that could reach the mainstream audience. He never lost faith. And Howlin' Wolf, the person he considered his most profound artist that he ever recorded, his belief was that if he had continued to produce Wolf, Wolf could have been as big as Elvis. He was really the fulfillment of all of Sam's imagination of music.
Yeah, somebody knocking on my door.
That's a little bit of Moanin' at Midnight from Howlin' Wolf, an early effort by Sam Phillips and Sun Records there in Memphis, Tennessee. And you quote him in the book as saying, this was the most different music I'd ever done.
The first time he ever heard Howlin' Wolf on a bad connection from KWEM in West Memphis, you know, with all the crackle and the pop, I said to myself, this is it. This is where the soul of man never dies.
And for him to say the use of the word different, mm-hmm. was like, you say this, like this was his highest compliment.
Oh, yeah. No. I mean, his whole thing was about to prize individualism in the extreme, as he would say. And if you weren't doing something different, you weren't doing anything. No, I mean, he believed in democracy. He believed in individuation. He believed in freedom. And they were all connected. But that was the fundamental of his belief, and that's what he talked to me about the first time I met him, not about the dates of, I recorded this on a Tuesday. He said, anybody can keep a diary. He said, it was the spirit of the music that mattered. Mm.
And so there was this openness to the studio that would come to be known as Sun. Wasn't called that initially.
Never was called that.
Yeah, the studio wasn't. Yeah. But while he's working on opening his studio, you mentioned radio, he was really into radio, mm-hmm. and had this vision of a radio station for the black community with a black staff.
He did. And, I mean, he got together with his brother-in-law, Jimmy Connolly, who was one of his great friends, and started working on it in 51 or 52 and sending in, their applications to the FCC. And it presented itself as a community service. Sam envisioned a radio station which would be a 24-hour station, which would reach out more in terms of community service and would also put African Americans in the running the whole station, which he never did it. But it's really interesting reading the application because it's quite eloquent in its presentation, again, of what Sam believed in.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to see what he did instead, which was to found WHER, which was a station entirely staffed by women and broadcasting to women. So he was still looking for underserved audiences.
Absolutely. No. I mean, he believed his Sam's wife, Becky, he thought had the best announcer's voice that he'd ever heard. And in a way, WHER was kind of his gift to Becky. But he had a strong belief. I mean, it wouldn't fit in with contemporary feminism.
No.
But he had a strong belief in the potential of women to present themselves, to represent themselves, and also to make a success of a radio station. So this WHER was the first all-girl station in the nation, as it was advertised, 1,000 beautiful watts of soul. And it surprised everybody, including the women that he hired to be the DJs, because each one of them, until a few days before they went on the air, thought she was the only one.
And this was the big reveal when they went on the air.
Yeah, well, I mean, they knew it by then, but it was... Yeah. I think people would find it hard to imagine how few women there were on the air, how... maybe they wouldn't find it hard to imagine.
I was just going to say, I don't think anyone would find that very hard to imagine at all. But in the midst of all this, so the 50s are going along, and he's got the Memphis Recording Service opened. Mm-hmm. Whole Jackie Brenston, Ike Turner thing has happened with Rocket 88.
His first number one hit in 1951, a song that has often been called the first rock and roll record. Rocket 88, baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
So he's made strides, connections with the black musical community, and into this. Walks Elvis Presley, and to people who do know the name Sam Phillips, he is inextricably linked to Elvis.
He had just graduated high school. He read a story in the newspaper in the Commercial Appeal, which told of the recording by a group of prisoners at the Tennessee State Penitentiary in Nashville.
The band was the Prisonaires.
The Prisonaires, just walking in the rain, right. And so Sam was quoted in the story and described as someone who was open to new talent of every kind, whose ears were unprejudiced, not just racially, but in every way. He was looking for untested, untried, unproven talent. When Elvis read that, within 2 or 3 weeks of that article appearing, Elvis came into the studio for what's called a personal record, where he paid $4 for 2 sides for an acetate. Now, in later years, the myth grew up, and fostered by Elvis, I think, that he had recorded it either for his mother's birthday or for his mother, which and right. Everything Elvis did was for his mother, so that's not inaccurate. But the point was, I think, without any question, the reason he went in was to put himself in the way of discovery, to give, you know, it's like a kid playing baseball who, I mean, I know when I was playing baseball, I'd always imagine there's that major league scout.
The scout, yeah.
Well, it didn't work out quite in that way, but Sam, by this time, this is summer of 53 going into 54, there were two things operative. One was that what he had imagined would happen hadn't happened. He had one hit after another on his new Sun label, but they were R&B hits, and they sold, in the case of The Prisoners, 30,000. That was a big hit, but it was 30,000. But he couldn't break through that ceiling. It was not reaching the mainstream audience that the music deserved to.
Meaning the white audience.
The white audience, right. We should say mainstream equals white.
Yeah.
And he believed the only way he was going to break through that wall of segregation, of categorization, was to have a white artist who could represent the music. And once that music was embraced by that mass audience, that white audience, that there was nothing that could hold back the African-American music, and that through the doors would come great black artists of the time like Ray Charles, Fats Domino, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Bo Diddley. There was no question in his – I mean, the fact that there was no question in his mind this would happen didn't mean it would happen.
Right.
But
right.
That is what happened.
Yeah. And so it's not like Elvis enters the building and the light bulb goes on and he says, that's my guy that I've been looking for. It takes work. You describe these – you know, long, arduous rehearsal processes, and when the breakthrough finally happens, as is so often the case, it's just, you know, it's the end of a long day, and they're kind of goofing around in the studio.
They've worked all night. Elvis, the guitarist Scotty Moore, the bass player Bill Black, all have jobs to go to in the morning, and they take a break, and Elvis starts flailing away on guitar, singing a song unlike anything else he had sung that night. Sam says, what are you doing? And Scotty says, we don't know.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right. Papa done told me too. Son, that guy you fooling with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama, anyway do.
Elvis Presley with That's All Right, Mama. And at this point, the story of Sam Phillips takes a turn that Sam had been waiting so long for, where he is now crossing over. And the music with this white artist, with this black sound, is, you know, it's being heard first on the radio. There were a couple of live shows that surprised everybody. And then, you know, then we get into, he finds he's swimming in shark-infested waters.
Well, he's facing unbelievable opposition from the white DJs most of all, but to some extent from the black DJs, but most of all from the white DJs who are not going to play anything like this. And he goes out, he's putting 60,000 miles a year on his car going around. He says, I knew these people, but I tried to persuade them, and eventually he did. But the other thing, the thing that might be less expected, although if anybody studied the wages of capitalism, they might understand this, he had these hits, regional hits. Well, a hit will put you out of business if you're a small independent label, or if you're a small business. A hit will put you out of business more often than it'll benefit you. And the reason it will is because you have to pay all your costs up front. You have to pay the pressing plant. You have to pay the fabricator if you're making an album. And then the question is, how do you get paid?
Mm-hmm.
And you're not going to get paid by the distributors unless they feel there's another hit in the chute, because you might be out of business next year, and why should they throw their money away?
Meanwhile, so, you owe royalties.
That's right, you owe royalties. So Sam was on the verge of bankruptcy when he sold Elvis's contract in 55.
$35,000?
The most that had ever been paid for a single artist.
And we look at that now and we think, man, you know, you can't even buy an apartment for that, and you're selling Elvis Presley.
Not even a hot dog.
No. So, but for the time, yeah, it was, I mean, there are a couple of points in the book where you, Peter, I think it's in your voice, are wondering whether we're hearing in what Sam says later, some after-the-fact rationalization.
Definitely. Not at this point, but in many cases, I would say, but I know what Sam would say here, and then I will introduce a voice because the dialogue with Sam it goes on in my head.
Yeah.
And I felt like it's only fair. I know what he would say. I know that some of the things I say would run counter to what he believed or what he chose to.
The biographer as adversary with the person he's writing about.
Well, I'd say it is sort of adversary, but it's also as proponent for the person I'm writing for, his retaining his voice. But, I mean, you'll see in the introduction, I mean, Sam said, you know, don't put me in a good light. Tell the damn truth and ferret out the BS, you know. There's been too much of that.
Yeah.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Now, we started by talking about Sam Phillips as producer, you know. There was no term like that before he came along. But in the case of a Johnny Cash song like I Walk the Line, as you describe it in the book, it was a very different song. And it was Sam who's kind of like pushing Johnny constantly. No, you got to do it. It's got to be faster. It's got to have, you know, it's got to have this beat to it.
Right.
I mean, he really produced that song.
I think in the case of I Walk the Line, John was adamant that he didn't want to, you know, he didn't want to do it speeded up. But he embraced it fairly quickly once he heard it.
And happiness I've known proves that it's right. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
He also was working with two musicians who were very primitive with their instruments. I mean, primitive is the wrong word, but they were not practiced.
Right.
His guitarist could play one note at a time. That was Luther Perkins. And John would get so exercised about it because there was no splicing back then.
Right.
Sam wasn't going to splice. He wanted a live, raw, spontaneous, you know, performance. And he said John would get so exercised at times, he'd say, look, let's just do it with another guitarist. And Sam would say, no, this is your sound. This is part of your sound. This is what makes you different. And he prized Luther's playing, and it wasn't prizing incompetence. The difference between Sun and what sometimes was seen as punk or whatever is not that he was trying to sound, he was not looking for musicians to sound bad. They were all aspiring to a kind of beauty.
And massive success. I mean, uncovering Ike Turner and Elvis Presley and Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis, and yet somehow by the time all of these stars are shining at their brightest in the American musical sky, Sam Phillips is out of the picture. How does that happen?
Well, he was really involved in the music business from the day that he opened the doors at 706 Union on January 2nd, 1950, till about 1960. He continued in the business, but he had lost faith in it. He no longer saw the future. But I think more than anything, and this is the only way I can put it, when I say he no longer saw the future, he didn't actually see the future of the independent operator in the business, and I think he was correct in that. By the end of the 60s, almost all the independent labels had been bought up by the majors. Now you're dealing with international conglomerates or cartels or whatever, feel the burn. But the other thing was, and this is more to the point, I think, is you think about how much goes in, the all-consuming nature of a great artist, of a creative mind, and how many people, I mean, you could look at somebody like Ralph Ellison, who could never go on. I mean, think of what he put into Invisible Man.
Right.
And he could never go beyond that.
Right.
And I think Sam felt his heart, I mean, whether he felt consciously or unconsciously, his heart and his soul were no longer in it, and he wasn't going to, you know, he wasn't going to continue if he were not totally dedicated. And eventually he went back to radio as number one love, and he was totally committed to that.
Right. Let me just kind of ask a kind of summing up question here, because he believed so firmly in the power of this music that it just needed to get out there.
Right.
If there were no Sam Phillips, would this music have somehow gotten, would there have been someone else in the right place at the right time, or was there something specific about Sam that he was the person that we needed at that place in time to unlock that door?
I think he was the person that was needed, but it would have gotten out in one way or another. I mean, Sam would have said, I'm not the only damn person in the world who did this. And the impact, I mean, he's operating as a one-man operation in a tiny, everybody should go to Memphis right after the show. I mean, it's a tiny one-room studio. I mean, it's unbelievable that all this music that revolutionized the world should have come out of that. But it did. But the point is, no, he the music was surging to get out, and that was one of the things. Sam envisioned that long before there was such a thing as rock and roll. Sam envisioned something that would ultimately be called rock and roll. And the reason he envisioned it was because it was in the air. It wasn't that he was the only person perceiving it. But he's the only person I've ever run into in my own travels, in this kind of role, who had a whole philosophical construct to put in it and who believed in it so strongly. It had nothing to do, I mean, from the very start, it had nothing to do with selling the music, with filling a catalog. It was almost a crusade on his part to make a vision that he had from a very early age come true.
Fortunately, it's a purely theoretical question because Sam Phillips was there, and he did help invent rock and roll, and he did discover all of these amazing talents who have sort of streaked across the sky of the American music scene, and it's all detailed in Peter Guralnick's book, Sam Phillips, The Man Who Invented Rock and Roll. Peter, this has been really fascinating. Thanks very much.
Oh, it's been great. I've really enjoyed it.
Do you subscribe to the Soundcheck podcast? Leave us a rating and a review in the iTunes store by searching for Soundcheck and clicking on Ratings and Reviews. We'd really appreciate your feedback. Thanks for listening. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.
Well, you've been strutting, 'cause now you know how to do a little bit. Baby, let's go.